Moabites come from? Lot. After Lot had to leave, and he lost his wife, then his daughters came up with that incestuous plan to lie with her father, and Ammon was born, and then Moab was born, and they had been enemies of Israel all along the way there. We referenced in chapter 8 of Nehemiah, there was a public reading, and then also in chapter 9, the one thing that I failed to realize, and it escaped my notice, you turn to Deuteronomy 31, 10 to 13, and in the law it said there was to be a public reading of the law every 7 years. And so this wasn't like something new that they had never done before. God's intention was all along, when the law had been given, to gather the assembly together and to read the law publicly. So they've been doing that some here. Now whether these readings that we've been seeing in Nehemiah 8 and 9 as well as chapter 13 coincide with the seventh year or not, I don't know that we can determine that, but at least we see in the law the original intention of God was, I want this covenant read every 7 years. So they did that, and they came to conclude that there was a presence of the Moabites and the Ammonites, and they were not to be allowed in the assembly. What was the reason that was given here in verse 2? All right, you can go back and look in these passages here. Rick is correct. They had failed to give, he says, had failed to give bread and water to the Israelites as they wandered. I think this was after they had left the mountain. And after Numbers 13 and 14, when the spies episode was kind of fell apart. And they then had to wander for 40 years. Well, in that wandering, they were then poised to go take the land. They had to pass through the land of Ammon and Moab. And they had asked, now look, you know, don't give us bread and water. We'll pay for it. And what had been the response on the part of Ammon and Moab? They said, we're not helping you at all. So God didn't forget that. God doesn't forget that. And then he also mentioned something else in verse 2. There to not be allowed because what else had happened? Remember the episode with Balaam and how he had gotten the king of Balak, who was the king of Moab. He had wanted Balaam to come and curse them. And instead of cursing them, what did Balaam do? He blessed them. And so God remembered that as well. How Balak, of course, Balaam didn't turn out to be too good a fellow after all, did he? Because he got them to, not only did he not curse them, but he got them to get Israel to compromise and bow down to the Moab gods and play the harlot with them. So those reasons are given, and so they were to be excluded from the assembly. And that was discovered when they read the law. Now, in verses 4 through 9, we have a specific example of this. Who is mentioned in verses 4 through 9? Tobiah. Now, where have we heard the name Tobiah before? Has he been a central character in this story? Well, early on in the chapters, what had been his efforts? That's right. I mean, he, along with the other fellow's name was Sanballat. Together they had opposed Nehemiah every step of the way in his efforts to rebuild the wall. You go back even to the first chapter. Well, excuse me, it'd be the fourth chapter, I think, is where we see Tobiah really making his opposing efforts. They were mentioned, though, for the first time in chapter 2 and verse 10. Where was Tobiah from? You're not too talkative today, are you? Chapter 2 and verse 10. Where is he from? I can wait. He's from Ammon. He's an Ammonite. So here we have this specific example of what's being excluded here based on the reading of the law. Tobiah was from Ammon. And what had been done for him that was especially, must have been especially distasteful to Nehemiah? Yeah, that's right. I like, apartment's a good word. They had taken one of the rooms that was meant for storage, to store the collection of the tithes and the offerings, And he sort of set up a little house there. And he was allowed to live there. Who was it that assisted him in this? But, I mean, did he just get in there on his own? Eliashib. And who was he? He was the high priest. So it wasn't just anybody. I mean, you're talking, to me, this is treasonous. Absolutely treason. Shouldn't have been allowed to happen. And we learned back in chapter 6, 17 through 19, what had Tobiah done with respect to his marriage? How did he sort of have an inside track here to the remnant? Well, he had married into one of the leading families of the remnant. And so he had this connection. Now he's got the help of the high priest, and he sort of sets up shop inside the, I mean, not just in the city, but inside the temple. But one more piece of information, and we look at verse 6 of chapter 13. What really allowed this to happen? Nehemiah was gone. Where did he go? He went back to Persia. And as we recall, back in chapter 2 and verse 6, when Nehemiah first asked Artaxerxes to go, he first asked permission to go back and rebuild the walls. What were some of the questions that the king had asked him? Yeah, how long are you going to be gone, and when are you going to come back? So apparently his return had a some sort of a limit, a time limit on it. He had to go back and either get permission for an extended stay, or he went back. I don't think it says here in this text how long he was gone. Maybe he served for a while, again, as cupbearer to the king. That's not stated, but for whatever reason, he went back. And for however long he stayed, we don't know, but he came back. And when Nehemiah comes back, what does he find? He finds Tobiah in the temple. And he knows who's responsible for it. It's Eliashib, the high priest. Now, put yourself in Nehemiah's shoes. How would you have felt? That's terrible. So what did Nehemiah do? He threw him out. It says there in verse 8, it was very displeasing to me, so I threw all of Tobiah's household goods out of the room. I've read different commentaries this past week, and some expositors will say that literally means Nehemiah did it himself, or some of them say that he had it done. Either he did it or he ordered it done. He's behind it either way. He had Tobiah removed. And the rooms were cleansed. He sort of had it fumigated. He wanted all the filth out of there because this was an unclean Ammonite. And these were rooms that were set aside for the sole purpose of housing or storing the tithes and the offerings that were used in the work and the service, the worship of the temple. Now, I've sort of just asked you a question here. This is just sort of a thought question. This is question 9. I want you to compare this to Matthew 21, 12 and 13. When you read Matthew 21, 12 and 13, what is it that you read there? That's the second time Jesus cleansed the temple. He did it the first time, and that's in John chapter 2. But in Matthew 21, we have the second cleansing. And this is right at, it's on Monday of what is his last week. Do you see any similarity? I mean, I'm not trying to make anything really out of this, but do you see any similar points? What did Jesus do when he cleansed the temple? Why were there money changers in the temple anyway? People had to come. It's Passover. People had to come, and what did Jews have to do during Passover? They had to make their offerings. Well, a lot of Jews, historians will say, a lot of Jews came to Jerusalem and they didn't bring their offering with them. They would buy one once they got to the city. And so what had the Pharisees done? They said, well, you know, we can make some money at that. And so they set up shop, they set up tables in the temple, and they were buying and selling and trying to make a little money off that. And when Jesus found that, what did he do? He made a whip, didn't he? And did he physically throw them out of the temple? He drove them out. And he said, stop making you. This is my house of prayer. You're making it a den of thieves or a den of robbers. They had just profaned the temple. Well, what's Nehemiah doing here? He sees Tobiah in here. He's got no right to be in there because, again, the law said there's to be no foreigners in the assembly. You see a similarity there? I see two godly men. One is the man, Christ, and the other is this godly man named Nehemiah we've been talking about. And they don't want any defiling taking place here in the temple. Righteous indignation. Now, whether, again, Nehemiah physically threw Tobiah out on the street or he had it done, Jesus made this strand or this whip, and he drove them out, overturned their tables. And he's saying, both are saying, that's enough of that. We won't have that anymore. Take proactive action. Be angry and sin not, the Bible says, right? When sin is being committed, we need to be indignant over that. And I see Nehemiah doing that just like Christ did. So just a little food for thought as we make that comparison. All right, now look at verses 10 through 31. And that's the right. Yes, Bobby, go ahead. Well, maybe so. Well, I would think so. Bobby's point is that if Elisha should have and most likely would have shared in the guilt of letting Tobiah set up, what happened to him? Did he lose his job as high priest? Maybe he died in the time that Nehemiah was gone. There's a lot of possibilities there. But I don't think that he would have gotten off scot-free once Nehemiah got back and found that he was responsible. In fact, you'll see there in verse 7, as Nehemiah writes it, I came to Jerusalem and learned about the evil that Eliashib had done for Tobiah. So he knew who was responsible. It was Eliashib who was responsible for that being allowed to happen. That's a good point to make. Okay. In the rest of the chapter, I think we can divide it up into three main sections, and these are other failures that Nehemiah had to address. And we'll look at these one by one. Let's look at the first one, and it is tithes had not been given, verses 10 through 14. Nehemiah says, I also discovered that the portions of the Levites had not been given them. Well, again, who provided for the Levites? How did they get their sustenance? It was the people. Yeah, the tithes were given. The Levites would then take that part, and then they would give a tenth of the tithe, or a tithe of the tithe, to the priests. So everything was arranged. Every provision was made. But the portions for the Levites and the priests had not been gathered and collected, and this led to a sad reality. The middle part of, or the last part of verse 10, what was made to happen because of this failure? They did. I mean, they've got to eat. They've got to live somehow. So they had to return back to the fields and sort of leave their temple work. Well, what's that going to cause? You see a ripple effect there? What if they're not at the temple doing their tasks? The entire system sort of comes to a grinding halt if the ones who were appointed to this task are not there doing their work as God had ordained. But they've got to provide for themselves and their family, so they've sort of left that. That's a failure. See what happens when one doesn't do his job? It just doesn't affect him. It affects everybody else that he's connected to. All are involved. All are affected. So Nehemiah had to address this. And it caused God's house to be forsaken in a very real way. So, and that, look at Nehemiah's words, verse 11. Who did he blame? Who's to blame for this? The ones who are the leaders, the officials. My version says, so I reprimanded the officials, the leaders. When there's failure, it starts at the top. And so he reprimands the officials, and blames them, so to speak. They allowed this to happen and they were reprimanded. But also, go back to chapter 10. This is something that I should have asked and I did not. But back in chapter 10, what was that document back there? Remember back in chapter 9, they made that great confession? And then in chapter 10, they signed this pledge or this vow, the covenant. What's verse 37 say of chapter 10? What have they vowed to do? They vowed to pay their tithe. So not only were they breaking the law, that's the primary concern, but they'd given their word back there, and that they even signed it. But what about that word now? They're not honoring what their word. They've gone back against their word. So that's a failure. And Nehemiah has to address that, so he sort of restores the order. Look at verses 11 through 13 of chapter 10. The end of verse 11. I gathered them together and restored them to their posts, that is the Levites. All Judah then brought the tithe of the grain and oil into the storehouses. And in charge of the storehouses, I appointed Shemaliah, the priest, Zadok, the scribe, Padiah of the Levites. In addition to them was Hanan, the son of Zachar, the son of Mattaniah, for they were considered reliable, and it was their task to distribute to their kinsmen. Who do you put in charge of a task that needs to be done the right way? Well, you're quiet this morning. I don't like that. Who do you put in charge of a task that needs to be done the right way? Somebody that's reliable. Somebody who you know will get the job done. Do you give a position responsibility to a slacker? You don't do that in your business, do you? You lose money if you do that. You lose a lot of money. But what about the Lord's business? Absolutely. And along those lines, that's a good point. Turn to 1 Timothy chapter 3. I don't want to get too far off this, but this verse comes to mind. 1 Timothy 3. Look at verse 10. Talk about deacons in the church. Who do you make it? Well, I shouldn't say who do you make a deacon, but who do you appoint a deacon? What's this say? Let them be tested first, then let them serve as deacons. So there's a sense in which we show our worth when we're involved in some great work, and then we're given positions of responsibility. You don't put somebody in charge of a task to make them more faithful, do you? That's not how it works. That's not going to work. So here was this failure. Here had been this great failure. It affected not only the Levites and their families, but also the entire system of work and worship with respect to the temple. Nehemiah comes back, sort of clears this up, and he puts responsible people. Does the King James use the word reliable there at the end of verse 13, or does it use a different word? Blameless? Okay. Someone who's blameless, who's reliable, who's trustworthy, who's been proven. And Nehemiah realized the importance. They said, all right, now you guys are in charge of this. Let's not drop the ball on this again. This is important work that's got to get done. So he addressed that failure. Do you see any lapse of time? I don't know, the text doesn't say this, but when you see something like this, how soon do you get on it? Right now. You get on it right now. You don't let grass grow under your feet, as the old saying goes. You address it in a hurry. So he restored order to this, and it was very important that be done. But look also in verse 14. We haven't seen one of these verses in a while. What's Nehemiah also do? He prays. See, here's this praying man. What's he say? Remember me for this, O my God, and do not blot out my loyal deeds which I have performed for the house of my God and its services. He continues to seek God's favor and to pray. So there's the first failure addressed through verse 14. All right, what's the second failure he takes care of? This takes us down to question 11. All right, we have the Sabbath being profaned or defiled. And I see this happening in two ways in these verses. What's the first thing listed as he observes this? He says, I saw in Judah something happen. What was going on in Judah based on verse 15? Yeah, some were treading the wine presses. I mean, they were physically working on the Sabbath. That's a clear violation of the law. Exodus 20, when the covenant was given at the mountain. Remember the Sabbath day, keep it holy. 6 days you shall work. You got 6 days to do this work. God says, you leave the seventh day alone. That's a day for me. So that's clearly going against what had happened. But also then look at the next part of the verse. What else was happening? I mean, that's bad enough, but then something else was going on. Yeah. They were engaging in commerce on the Sabbath with pagans. What would pagans have cared about the Sabbath day?
Another day for them.
Nobody make money. And they realized, here are these people here in this city, they have to make sacrifices to their gods. So we'll just come up here and we'll sell them the things that they need. That's a money-making opportunity for us. So they were engaged in that. Go back again to chapter 10. Look at verse 31 this time. Again, what had been part of that pledge? First part of the verse. What did they promise? We won't buy or sell grain on the Sabbath. Well, what are they doing? They've gone against their word again. So Nehemiah has to address this. More than likely, it seems to me, these failures would have started to materialize and start when Nehemiah was gone. You think? That's what I would think. How long he was gone, we don't know. But they sure looked like they were determined when they signed that pledge in chapter 10. Then we learned in chapter 13, Nehemiah had been gone for some time. Maybe he was gone for a year, months, we don't know. But as while he's gone, we see that the spirituality sort of dips, takes a dive, if you will, and things start happening again that shouldn't be happening. Maybe these things happened while he was back. We don't know. But if I had to guess, I would pick the first one rather than the second one. But at any rate, wrong is wrong. It doesn't matter when they did it, whether he was there or not. They shouldn't be doing it in the first place. So how does Nehemiah address this? What's he do? Verse 17, I reprimanded the nobles. Again, he addresses the leaders. He says, what is this evil thing you are doing by profaning the Sabbath? You're not keeping in esteem or you're not regarding the Sabbath day as you should. Then he says something else in verse 18. What's he saying in verse 18? Well, before that. Yeah. See, in this lesson, we're trying to establish he's continually making these links or these connections back to the past. And what about the past, Rebecca, did he say? We got in trouble for this before. This is what led to our troubles in the first place. They did not obey. They did not observe the teachings of the law. Verse 18. And look how he says this. Did not your fathers do the same, so that our God brought on us and on this city? See what he's saying? He says, look around us. We're still bearing the consequences of what our fathers did back there, and now you're doing the very same thing they did. It didn't work for them, and it won't work for us either. That's his point. You are adding to the wrath on Israel by profaning the Sabbath. You're not helping. You're digging the same old hole that we had been in all this time. So he reprimands them again, rebukes them through verse 18. And then in verse 19, this is his proactive steps. What does he say to do, Kevin? Starting in verse 19. He closes the gates and he does something else too. He puts guards. When does he want the gates closed? Before the Sabbath begins, and they stay closed how long? Till after the Sabbath. I want these gates shut and kept closed. Nobody comes in or out. We're going to observe this Sabbath day like the Lord wants us to. Well, you're a pagan coming to do business, and you come up there like every other Sabbath. Now, you find the doors closed, but you've come to make money. You don't care about the Sabbath, so there you are sort of camped out outside the city walls there. Well, Nehemiah sees you. What's he say to you? Now, you get the idea, he was not wishy-washy about this. He was serious. I'm going to run you off. You're to leave, and if you don't leave, I'm going to move you by force. You get out of here. We're not engaging in business. This is our holy day. And it's just not going to work out like it has been for you. That's just tough. You're just going to have to move. So he orders the pagans away and warns them. You'll see there in verse 18, if you do so again, I will use force against you. Last part of verse 18, what's it say? Or, I'm sorry, the last part of verse 21, pardon me. What's the last statement of the verse? They didn't come anymore. They knew Nehemiah meant business. So they quit coming. And that's the way it should have worked. So I want you to be impressed with this man. He means what he's doing. And this is what leaders do, isn't it? When there's a problem, that happens. Think about, let's say, 1 Corinthians 5. What was the problem with the church in Corinth? Well, we had a man sleeping with his father's wife. What did the church do? Nothing. They hadn't done a thing. How many churches, and we don't take a survey, but so many churches, how many churches just let sin and let situation just drag on for years? How does that help the situation? That don't help it at all. When do you deal with something? When you first notice it. When it's small. Aren't problems easier to solve when they're small than when you let them grow and fester in these great big... They're much easier to solve. So we learned an example from this man. When he saw this, he got right on it and he came down with both feet. You're going to stop this? And I'll deal with the pagans. I'm going to drive them out of here. Rebuke them for that sin. So again, we see this great man. Verse 22, what else did he command? He tells Levites to do what? You cleanse yourselves, you purify yourselves, and then you come as gatekeepers. You're going to act, or you're going to serve now in another capacity to sanctify the Sabbath day. So Nehemiah is doing and trying all that he can to make sure that the Sabbath day and the original intentions by God are being honored. And it's not going to be defiled or profaned. He does one more thing. Last part of verse 22. What's he do? He prays again. What's his prayer this time? He says, "For this also remember me, O my God, and have compassion on me according to the greatness of thy loving kindness." He prays for success and compassion. And he's just really going about this the right way. And spare me, yes. All right. So anything through verse 22 that anybody has, comments or questions? If you ever want a blueprint to follow, you look at Nehemiah, how he dealt with situations, how he dealt with problems. And this is a formula for success. For elders, for fathers in their home, for leaders in any collective activity, this is the blueprint right here you can follow. And it's tried and true and it works. Totally. All right. What is the third failure that's addressed starting in verse 23? All right. Here we have this. It's a problem that would not go away. We've dealt with this on more than one occasion. Ezra dealt with it in Ezra 9 and 10 of his book. When we interjected the prophecy of Malachi, he had a section of his prophecy against this practice. And as we came to conclude, it says in Malachi 2 that the tears had covered the altar of the Lord, and we determined that to have been the tears of women who had been put away by their husbands unfaithful so they could marry these pagan women over here. And yet we see it again. They've given their daughters to the sons of the pagans and taken their daughters as wives for their sons. Well, go back one more time to chapter 10. Look at verse 30. We keep going back to that chapter three times in this lesson. But back in that chapter, they had given their word. And they signed this pledge. What does verse 30 say? They promised what? We're not going to give our... We're not going to have these marriages anymore. So once again, for the third time, they violated their word. They didn't keep their word about that. So now Nehemiah must address it again. Well, it also caused, back in this chapter, it also caused some practical problems. Not only was it just wrong to have these marriages, but something else was happening because of these marriages. What does it say in the verse 24 of Nehemiah 13? Yeah. See, what was being lost? Their identity was being lost. Because of these mixed marriages, I mean, here you have a Jew, and say he married some woman from a surrounding nation. Well, her culture was important to her. Her language was important to her. And so you've got these two cultures now being blended together. And so, well, let's teach little Johnny here. Let's teach him the best of both worlds. You know, that kind of thing. But what was happening to the culture of God's people is being watered down. It's being diluted with that which should have happened in the first place. And as Nehemiah writes it, verse 24, as for their children, half spoke in the language of Ashdod, which was Philistia, the Philistines, and none of them was able to speak the language of Judah. So again, we see this loss of their identity as God's people. Pardon me. Nehemiah showed his great disdain for this. What did he do, verse 25? Now, we saw he pitched Tobiah out earlier. What's he do now? He strikes them and pulls out their hair. How would you like that? Whether it was the hair from their beards or their head. When you pulled out someone's hair, that was a show of what? It was anger. It was punishment. It was rebuke. And so, it's not that he just said, well, you know, you shouldn't do this. No, he dealt with them severely. And again, what does he bring up? Here's another link to the past. What's he remind them of? Haven't you learned any? What if a person won't learn from history? I don't care who he is. The one who doesn't learn from history, they're saying is doomed to repeat its mistakes. And that happens. So he says in verses 26 and 27 of Nehemiah 13, did not Solomon, king of Israel, sin regarding these things? Yet among the many nations there was no king like him, and he was loved by his God, and God made him king over all Israel. Nevertheless, the foreign women caused him even to sin. Do we then hear about you that you have committed all this great evil by acting unfaithfully against our God by marrying foreign women? You can turn back and read these texts in 1 Kings 11. That was God's concern. Early on as king, he was faithful, but he fell away. And the text back there says that his wives turned his heart away from following God. And that's the concern. And now the remnant, they're doing the very same thing. And so Nehemiah brings up the history here. But especially painful is Eliashib's actions. Look there in verse 28. What had he done? Even one of the sons of Joiada, the son of Eliashib, was a son-in-law to Sanballat. Now we've seen Tobiah's name mentioned, now we see Sanballat, and they were the two arch-enemies of Nehemiah. It's bad enough marrying a pagan, which is a violation of the law, but one of them even married in Sanballat's family, who had done so much to undermine Nehemiah. That had to have been painful for Nehemiah to have uncovered this piece of information. So, one more time. He rebukes the situation, but look in verse 29. What's he do? He prays again. Remember them, O my God, because they have defiled the priesthood and the covenant of the priesthood and the Levites. So here's these three situations. No tithing. He addresses it. He prays. They profane the Sabbath. He addresses it. Corrects it. He prays. They intermarry with the pagans. He addresses it. He corrects it. And he prays. I think you've got to give Nehemiah credit for being consistent. He was a godly man. And he wanted these issues to stop inside of Judah. All right. He purified the priests from their foreign defilements, verses 30 through 31. He says that there. And he then makes or caused them to sort of refocus their attention on their duties. You're the priest of God. And if you're involved in these sinful things, there's no way that you can serve as priests. Let's make the application. We've asked this question before this quarter. Who's the priest of the kingdom today? We are. We're the priests. What if we defile ourselves? What's that going to do to our worship? Or our ability to worship? It's going to remove it. That's the problem with sin. And so he sort of gets them to focus back on their attention. And the last verse of the book, how does the book of Nehemiah end appropriately? Another prayer. What's the prayer this time as he closes? He says, remember me, O my God, for good. Just a short prayer, but to the point. All the good that I'm trying to do, I want you to remember me for this. I want to end with this with this quote. I hope the type is where you can read it. But I got this out of one of my books, and I thought it was a good way to sort of end our class. And let me just sort of give this quick summary. This writer says, the final chapter of Nehemiah underscores the impression already created by the earlier chapters about this man. He was fervent in his zeal for Yahweh, or Jehovah. He possessed a holy boldness that made him brutally blunt with both friend and foe. He was a masterful organizer and motivator. He was a man of action. But even more important, he was a man of the Scripture and a man of prayer. A man who approaches God on his knees will stand tall in any generation. I just say that because, you know, you and I can be a Nehemiah. We certainly can. And so I hope you've enjoyed this quarter's study with Ezra and Nehemiah. Sometimes I think they're sort of overlooked as a couple of Old Testament books, but if you take the time to dig through the chapters, you can find there's many great, wonderful lessons in these two books to help us serve Christ today. We have about 10 seconds. Anybody want to offer a quick comment? I didn't need as much time, did I? But you weren't talking earlier, so I had to talk. I had to take all the time up today. All right, those who are going to be in the quarter out here next week, we have the folders for Romans. You need to get one of those. There'll be no class because of our singing on Wednesday night, so we'll start Romans, the Lord willing, next Sunday morning. Thank you for your good comments, not just today, but all this past quarter.